Welcome to this ninth edition of the Becoming Human in the Cosmos podcast, based on the book of the same title on Amazon. This podcast will center on the fourth chapter, part two, titled The Plan of Happiness and Agency. We discussed the plan of happiness in the previous podcast. We'll discuss agency in this one. Quote, "For it must needs be that there is an opposition in all things. If not so, righteousness could not be brought to pass. Neither wickedness, neither holiness nor misery, neither good nor bad, having no life, neither death, nor corruption nor incorruption, happiness nor misery, neither sense nor insensibility. Wherefore it must needs have been created for a thing of naught. Wherefore there would have been no purpose in the end of its creation." Book of Mormon, pages 57 through 58, previously cited. William Temple, Archbishop of Canterbury, expressed the need for opposition in these terms, quote, "Which are our own best days, the days when we have nothing to perplex us or trouble us, or the days when, at considerable cost to ourselves, we have made some real effort against the evil which afflicted either ourselves or other people? Surely the latter. Surely we know that one of the best of the good things in life is victory, and particularly moral victory. But to demand victory without an antagonist is to demand something with no meaning. If, then, goodness is to exist up to the limit of what even we can understand, there must at least be an antagonist to be overcome. If you take all the evil out of the world, you will remove the possibility of the best thing in life. That does not mean that evil is good. What one means by calling a thing good is that the spirit rests permanently content with it for its own sake. Evil is precisely that with which no spirit can rest content, and yet it is the condition, not the accidental, but the essential condition of what is in and for itself the best thing in life, namely, moral victory." That is from Rune's Treasury of Philosophy, pages 1163 through 4. The philosopher William James, Essays in Pragmatism, writes this of the benefits of having a devil, quote, "The devil may be good. Although he be a principle of evil, yet the universe, with such a principle in it, may practically be a better universe than it could have been without. We find that a certain amount of evil is a condition by which a higher form of good is brought," page 49. Dr. Eben Alexander, from his near-death experience, writes of the necessity of evil, quote, "Evil was necessary because without it, free will was impossible, and without free will there could be no growth, no forward movement, no chance for us to become what God longed for us to be. Horrible and all-powerful as evil sometimes seem to be in a world like ours, in the larger picture, love was overwhelmingly dominant, and it would, ultimately, be triumphant." Proof of Heaven, Kindle location number 671. Choice. If there is a defining principle, an element that overarches all of our eternal lives, it is the matter of choice. It is also called agency and free will. As to whether man truly is free or predestined has been a major debate of theologians and philosophers for millennia. As I said at the beginning, I was going to take it for granted that God exists and move on from there, so I will also refuse to enter the debate on free will, assume it exists, and move on from there. If you don't want to believe in free will and choose to debate it, that's fine. You have your choice. But that's not my purpose in this book. Okay, sorry, flip it again. But no more than Isaac B. Singer, who said, "We must believe in free will. We have no choice." Location 1086 in Proof of Heaven by Ibn Alexander, previously cited. I have to give a location because it's on my Kindle, and there are no page numbers. Scientist Karl Popper previously cited doesn't support determinism. Quote, I think that determinism is a theory which is untenable on many grounds, and that we have no reason whatever to accept it. Indeed, I think that it is important for us to get rid of the determinist element in the rationalist tradition. Page 123. A possible compromise. This is an idea I'm still working on, so I can't offer much more than half-baked. But perhaps true agency exists only with the spirit, and true predestination exists only with the temporal or material world. As this world is the first combination of such, and our first experiences with that combining, then perhaps this explains our frustration at separating the two. I heard Nehru, the first president of India, quoted as saying, life is like a game of cards. The hand you are dealt is determinism. The way you play it is free will. I think that's close to right. Matter, it seems, is predestined. Every atom has a half-life that predetermines its existence. Our bodies grow old, decay, and die with no choice on our part whatsoever. The law of entropy prevails over all matter. Even the universe is scheduled to die via heat death and expansion, and all matter, according to inevitable half-life, decays into nothingness. But that doesn't mean our spirits are therefore without choice. We have the option of choosing our attitudes and how we deal with these material inevitabilities while we are here. Do we have pure, total freedom and liberty? No. Just degrees, samplings thereof. But we have the choice to do as we will with what we have. I think our limited agency here is a trial run. How we handle it will be an indication of what we do with greater liberty in the cosmos. Scripture's helpful. Consider the parables of the talents, where those who use their gifts wisely are rewarded with greater amounts, and similarly those who are faithful in a few things are made rulers over many. Luke chapter 19, verses 11 through 27, New Testament. I think our agency here is an example of a talent, perhaps the most important talent besides life we'll ever have. This life is a trial run. God gives us sample amounts, as in the above-mentioned parable of the talents, and then calls us to account. Most people see talents as such things as an ability to sing or hit a baseball. I won't argue with those ideas, but I think we need to greatly broaden our definitions and perceptions of talents. How do we handle the talent of life, of agency, of procreation, of family relationships, of power, of a good mind, of wealth, or, for the great majority of his children, of poverty? And yes, we must even see that as a gift. Easy for me to say. I enjoy the typically good American middle-class lifestyle and want materially for nothing, at least in comparison with the great majority of my brothers and sisters in this world. But Christ, getting from the Father the most bitter, gall-filled gift of all, the cup he had to drink in his final 3 days in mortality, said, the cup which my Father hath given me to drink, shall I not drink it? John chapter 18, verse 11. And I believe each of us receives that type of a cup from the Father. And as each cup has at least a bit of gall in it, notice Christ used the word given. These cups are therefore a gift, and if God gives us a gift, must we not accept it? And how we accept or reject it, and what we do with it, is an indication of how we'll use the gift of agency God has granted to us. But there is no force. There never is any force. But there are always consequences for our actions. God makes the consequences clear, then lets us choose. So do good parents as they bring up children. Though as a parent I have at times forcibly restrained my children, such as holding back a toddler who wanted to run out into traffic, but the restraints diminish as they grow. Same on an eternal scale, I believe, with us. A good example of the balance between agency and God's desires for us is found in the Old Testament story, where Israel rejects the government system of judges that God had given them and desires a king. This is also a rich source of counsel for those of us parenting children who make what we feel are wrong choices. Old Testament, 1 Samuel chapter 8, verse 7. And the Lord said unto Samuel, Hearken unto the voice of the people in all they say unto thee, for they have not rejected thee, but they have rejected me, that I should not reign over them. God doesn't wave his wand and change them all into frogs or whatever for disobedience. He says that this is what they've chosen, and his servant Samuel is to go along with it. God then tells them of the consequences of their choice. Verse 9. Now therefore hearken unto their voice, howbeit yet protest solemnly unto them, and show them the manner of the king that shall reign over them. End quote. So he and we must warn disobedient children of the consequences of the choices they make. After the long list of how a king will exploit them via forced labor and taxes, he sums it up in verse 18, previously cited. And ye shall cry out in that day because of your king, which ye shall have chosen you, and the Lord will not hear you in that day. End quote. In 19 through 20, the people refuse to consider these consequences and persist in their desire to be like all other nations, like teenagers who say, everyone else is doing it. Verses 19 through 20. Samuel reports this back to God, who says, verse 22, Hearken unto their voice, and make them a king. God has his way. We are given the agency to depart from it, but when we do, he warns us of the consequences and basically says, Don't come crying to me when all these problems pop up. I have given you a better way. You've rejected it. I told you what the results will be. Now you have the freedom to choose. This is good parenting. But this isn't all. God instructs Samuel to find the best king available in the land. If the children are going to go for number two instead of number one, then at least get the best number two available. 1 Samuel 9, 2, and 7. Further, God figures he can at least get some good use out of Saul, in that he will be able to lead his people against the Philistines. Verses 15 through 16. This is known as damage control, salvaging as much as you can from the train wreck. In this case, it took exceptional wisdom in the choosing of Saul, because he came from the least likely tribe to be governing Israel, and the least likely family in that tribe, verses 20 through 21. Samuel, instead of turning his back on Saul, because he is not God's first choice, instructs him in the word of the Lord, so once again Israel will get as good results as possible from an inferior choice, verse 27. From there, God even changes Saul's heart so he can qualify as a king over Israel. 1 Samuel chapter 10, verse 9. As this chapter is concluded, God again warns Israel that they have rejected him, but he's still working on their behalf with whatever is left for him to work with. Verses 17 through 19. Their agency, inferior choice, and God's continuing love and care for them are made clear. If we're looking for an example of agency, consequences, good parenting over rebellious children, and the responsibility we as parents have to our children in these matters, I think this is one of the best scriptural accounts available. We ask, what would Jesus do? And in this account, we find out how he would parent a troublesome child, balancing agency, consequences, and continuing love. Viktor Frankl, previously cited, shows us what choices we have even in the worst of circumstances, in his case, the Auschwitz concentration camp. Quote, The experiences of camp life show that man does have a choice of action. There were enough examples, often of a heroic nature, which proved that apathy could be overcome, irritability suppressed. Man can preserve a vestige of spiritual freedom, of independence of mind, even in such terrible conditions of psychic and physical stress. Everything can be taken from a man but one thing, the last of human freedoms, to choose one's attitude in any given set of circumstances, to choose one's own way, end quote. Yes, even in this worst of human situations, there were choices that could be made daily, choices that the Nazis couldn't take from anyone. Quote, every day, every hour, offered the opportunity to make a decision which determined whether you would or would not submit to those powers which threatened to rob you of your very self, your inner freedom, which determined whether or not you would become the plaything of circumstance, renouncing freedom and dignity to become molded into the form of the typical inmate. End quote. Pages 86 through 87. Howard Storm's near-death experience, My Descent into Death, pages 39 through 40 previously cited, shows how sobering the reality can be of our pursuing our own wills in spite of dire consequences. Consider God's attitude on war. Quote, God hates war. God has no desire for you to use violence and destructive means to assert your will over one another. But God allows wars to happen when you are determined to be at war. There have been occasions when God has let you suffer the consequences of your desire for war. Every war is a lesson that war is undesirable, and that you need to learn better ways of achieving harmony with one another. End quote. As an amateur student of history, I have read from many sources how both sides were eager to march off to our Civil War and World War I, both of which were hellaciously bloody conflicts in the long run. How many spirits of the young men mowed down as by a weed-eater at Antietam, Gettysburg, Ypres, the Somme, and the Marne, now in the spirit world, have gone through an attitude change to grow to something greatly different than that what they were in 1861 and 1914. Storm goes on, quote, the two world wars of the 20th century were not God's will. Those wars were not inevitable or necessary. They happened not because God wanted them, but rather because we wanted them so intensely that we got what we wanted. There was a conscious desire by enough people wanting to dominate other people that God let us suffer the results of our desire. End quote. He gives us this assurance, quote, God has ensured that every people who tried to assert control over another people has ultimately been defeated. End quote. And yet, you have a right to defend yourselves and come to the aid of the defenseless. Balance, judgment, wisdom. No one said it would be easy. Agency is a truly a universal principle in place from our pre-existent beginnings to our current mortal state and on into the following spirit world, where the departed spirits go when they die. From Destiny of Souls, New Case Studies of Life Between Lives, Michael Newton, Ph.D. In the spirit world, we are not forced to reincarnate or participate in group projects. If souls want solitude, they can have it. If they don't want to advance in their assignments, this too is honored. End quote, page 7. We have the right to self-determination, even with our death experience. Spiritual guides will honor poor decision-making. Ibid, previously cited, page 55. Newton does explain how free will and destiny work together. We can't escape the cumulative effects or consequences of lifetimes of bad choices, and we wouldn't want to escape the rewards of lifetimes of good choices. He says, people have the idea that free will and destiny are opposing forces. They do not realize that destiny represents the sum of our deeds over thousands of years in a multitude of incarnations. In all these lives, we had freedom of choice. Our current life represents all past experiences, both pleasant and unpleasant, and so we are the product of all our former choices. Page 371. I'm going to bypass the reincarnation aspect for now and deal with that later. I'll have to admit to being of a mixed mind on the subject. A later chapter brings a possible amalgam of reincarnation, creation, and evolution. It's the best I can do with these conflicting ideologies at this point. There are many near-death experiences that go into agency. Here's Joyce H. Brown's take. God permits us to make our own choices concerning our attitudes, actions, and especially reactions. God does not force us to do what is right during earth life, and we do not have the right to force someone else to do, quote, right, quote, or to make right decisions. Earth life is a time to learn from choices, end quote. Joyce Brown previously quoted, page 71. Her near-death experience, page 69, taught her that every choice I had made in attitude, thought, or action had an inescapable consequence, wanted or unwanted. I alone was responsible for what I had done with my life. This has major implications for our current political debates on such things as abortion, same-sex marriage, and the like. For these reasons, my views are usually, quote, liberal, end quote, on these subjects, but not for the current political reasons. I just have a rock-core attitude set that the agency of man is not to be interfered with, even if they choose to do wrong. Of course, if that wrong choice impinges on the life of another, say, the choice to murder, then force must be used to stop them. Let's take the example of abortion. Abortion, for me, is a moral evil. Now, I'm going to have many Latter-day Saint friends who are pro-life, and I want to stress and emphasize this for them again. Abortion, for me, is a moral evil, and should never be practiced except to save the life of the mother when it is veritably threatened. I think a compromise political solution would be to allow abortions in the first trimester, to allow them in and after the second trimester only if the mother's life was definitely at risk, and make the ghastly procedure of partial birth abortion the equivalent of murder, or at least manslaughter, holding the doctor, mother, and assistants guilty as accomplices, because in partial birth abortion, the baby could quite easily have lived outside the womb. Partial birth abortion is nothing more than infant murder, unless it could be demonstrated without a doubt that their mother would have died if giving birth, and that there was no other option such as cesarean available. I think those circumstances would be extremely rare, if not non-existent. If a woman can't figure out in the first 3 months whether she wants the baby or not, her choice is pretty much past affecting just her, and there's another life potential to consider. Here we get into the debate as to when a fetus is truly alive. Most religious people would agree that the spirit is what makes the flesh alive. Quote, "For as the body without the spirit is dead," end quote, James chapter 2, verse 26. The question is, just when does the spirit enter the fetus? Some religions hold that it is at the moment of conception. Others say not until the moment of birth. To thoroughly confuse matters, Betty Eady's book of her near-death experience, Embraced by the Light, tells us that the time of the spirit's entering the fetus is pretty much left up to the spirit. Quote, "He chose to begin his mortal life at his body's conception. I learned that spirits can choose to enter their mother's body at any stage of her pregnancy." Page 95, previously cited. Edie's insights are echoed in another book, Memories of God and Creation, by Shakuntala Modi, M.D. Via the process of regressive hypnosis, Modi probed the subconscious minds of his patients to retrieve their memories of their lives before the mortal incarnation. As to when the spirit enters the fetus, quote, "Not all the souls go into the fetus at the same time. Very few souls enter at the time of conception. As the fetus develops, the soul may come in at almost any time. Some might come in during the first, second, or third months, but the most popular month for entering the fetus is the fifth month. It's like a bell curve, with the fourth and fifth months being by far the most popular, though there are tales at both ends of it, with some spirits not coming into the body until after birth. Page 121 through 122. Michael Newton, who, like Modi, does regressive hypnosis, states flatly, quote, "I have never had a single case where a soul joined the fetus in the first trimester. There is not enough brain tissue for the souls to work with at this stage." Destiny of Souls, previously cited, page 382, 383. I personally adopt these views on this. Religions have no "thus saith the Lord" to substantiate their viewpoints. Edie's near-death vision and Modi's and Newton's hypnosis research are as close as we can come to a definitive word from the eternal realms on the situation. Since we can't know whether a fetus actually has a spirit animating it or not when planning an abortion, I would propose the above-mentioned political solution of abortions only in the first trimester to the abortion question. It is a point of view that will satisfy neither extreme of the issue, but for me it's a compromise that makes middle-of-the-road political sense. And as mentioned earlier, I feel this golden mean is where the truth lies, or at least a workable political policy. Now, all we have to do is get Congress to go along with the consensus of near-death visions and past-life regression hypnosis. Right. My ultimate attitude is this: if a child of God needs to have the mortal experience, not all do, then it won't be sent to a mother who would abort it. I personally don't think any of God's plans for any one of his children are cut short by abortion. What do we suppose, that God is in heaven going, "Oh, darn, they had an abortion. I'd planned on that child being a prophet. Rats, thwarted again." A man can't cut short or divert the plans of God any more than he can stand in the middle of the Mississippi River, put out his hand, and stop its flow. The act of abortion doesn't so much destroy the possibilities and destinies of God's spirit children, as it seriously hampers the spiritual growth and development of the mother and those who do the operation. These are the ones who are truly hurt by the anti-life procedures of the abortion, which must stem from an anti-life attitude, and which they must obtain kicking against the pricks of conscience, as described by Apostle Paul, until they have hardened their heart against the basic thrust of the cosmos. Paul describes kicking against the pricks of conscience in Acts chapter 9, verse 5, and 1 Timothy chapter 4, verse 2. The cosmos is pro-life, not in the political sense, but in the sense that the universe humans as the rosebush blossoms. End quote. Alan Watts, philosopher and author of the 1950s and 60s, can't give an exact chapter and verse on that. I heard it in a series of lectures on faith and reason from the American Scholar series of college lectures with Professor Kreeft. Those doing abortions are anti-life, and as a consequence are 180 degrees out of sync with the direction of the cosmos. It's like going to college and studying Lamarckian theories of species development, then imagining you can get a prime job in a biology laboratory doing DNA work or labors requiring a strong working knowledge of evolution. This ties in with that quote from Professor Nibley at the beginning of this chapter, that when we put ourselves at cross purposes with the cosmos, then all nature conspires to cross-check and frustrate us. But the cosmos also is pro-choice. Again, not in the current political sense, but as mentioned earlier in this chapter, there has to be an opposition in all things. Choices come to us because there are evil spirits countering the counsels of good spirits. The old cartoon picture about an angel on one shoulder and a devil on the other whispering conflicting ideas isn't far off the mark. Joyce Brown writes, previously quoted, "These darker spirits were unable to reach me when I chose positive, uplifting thoughts and activities, especially when I prayed or read the scriptures and pondered their spiritual messages. I had my freedom to choose what to think and what to do, and God was there to help me with my choices." End quote. Page 147. Or maybe an angel functioning under God's direction. Swedenborg, previously cited, says it's the function of angels, quote, "to impart charity and faith, to notice the direction in which the person's delight turns, and to modify and bend those delights toward what is good, so far as they can do so in the person's freedom. The person is in the middle and is not conscious of the evil or of the good, and being in the middle, he is in freedom to turn towards one or towards the other," page XIII-XIV, or Roman numerals 13 through 14. C.S. Lewis, Mere Christianity, writes, "God created things which had free will. That means creatures which can go either wrong or right, and free will is what has made evil possible. Why, then, did God give them free will? Because free will, though it makes evil possible, is also the only thing that makes possible any love or goodness or joy worth having. A world of automata, of creatures that work like machines, would hardly be worth creating. The happiness which God designs for his higher creatures is the happiness of being freely, voluntarily united to him and to each other in an ecstasy of love and delight." Page 52. Don Brubaker's near-death experience shows how literally these principles are applied. Quote, "Visions of wealth appeared before my eyes, like a three-dimensional movie. Diamonds, money, cars, gold, beautiful women, everything. I was overwhelmed by the vision. I could almost touch it. It seemed so real." Quote, "He could clearly hear the words, enjoy, enjoy, in one ear, and in the other, resist, resist. He felt as if he was caught in a huge tug of war. One party to the battle was Satan, who did exist and was fighting for his soul." As related in The Eternal Journey, Lundahl and Widdowson previously cited, page 231. Choice isn't always black and white easy. Should I rob a bank or not? Should I cheat on my spouse or not? It can be a finely nuanced affair as to the ultimate choice of whether to believe in and follow God. Quote, "We are, it would seem, always provided with sufficient materials out of which to fashion a life of credible conviction or dismissive denial. We are acted upon, in other words, by appeals to our personal values, our yearnings, our fears, our appetites, and our ego. What we choose to embrace, to be responsive to, is the purest reflection of who we are and what we love. That is why faith, the choice to believe, is in the final analysis an action that is positively laden with moral significance. Men and women are confronted with a world in which there are appealing arguments for God as a childish projection. But there is also compelling evidence that a glorious divinity presides over the cosmos, that God calls and anoints prophets, and that his word and will are made manifest through a sacred canon that is never definitively closed." Terrell L. Gibbons, Lightning Out of Heaven, BYU Magazine, Summer 2006, pages 28 through 29. Choice, at least for major eternal life decisions, has to be fairly weighed. The determining factor isn't the plethora of evidence on one side or the other, but your own inclinations, our own character, makeup. That's what tips our personal balance and, embarrassingly, shows us what kind of people we are. Now, why all this emphasis on agency or choice? My belief is that agency is the most important concept in the cosmos, and that understanding it is vital to understanding God and what he's doing. The proposed negation of agency is, to me, the, quote, "original sin," End quote. Yes, I know, Eve, the snake, and the apple have the time-honored title of original sin. I'm thinking in terms of chronology, the sin that came first in the cosmos, before the earth was even formed, before Adam and Eve ever strolled through their garden. I know of no other scriptural source or any source for this, save the LDS version in their sacred book, The Pearl of Great Price, so I'll quote it, page 9. Quote, "And I, the Lord God, spake unto Moses, saying, that Satan came before me, saying, Behold, here am I, send me. I will be thy son, and I will redeem all mankind, that one soul shall not be lost. Wherefore, give me thine honor. Wherefore, because that Satan rebelled against me and sought to destroy the agency of man, which I, the Lord, had given him, I caused that he should be cast down, and he became Satan, yea, even the devil, the father of all lies." Note the strong arguments here on Satan's behalf. His idea was to save all men, and none should be lost. In the current plan, which won out in this premortal debate, there are those who will be lost by virtue of the choices they make using their agency, which Satan would have taken from us. Satan's plan meant that we would come to earth and, in lockstep, like automatons and zombies, march through life, doing the same deeds, jumping through the same hoops, going through the same motions, and then all would have been processed, like a ride at Disneyland, back to the eternal realms where Satan, now with the honor of God, would have presided. In Dostoevsky's classic, The Brothers Karamazov, there's a dialogue between a grand inquisitor, who I will cast in the role of Satan, and a Christ-like figure. The discussion involving rhetoric from the grand inquisitor only presents Satan's arguments against freedom. But what Satan has to say about the drawbacks of freedom, as applied to the human race, are, quite possibly, arguments Lucifer used in the pre-existence to try and win his point. Though not persuasive to me, they are nonetheless good arguments, and we who love freedom and agency must be prepared to counter them. Example, page 253 from Brothers Karamazov, quote, "Better that you enslave us, but feed us. Freedom and earthly bread in plenty for everyone are inconceivable together, for never will they be able to share among themselves." End quote. Much of this argument presages communism, which came, if I have my chronology correct, only about a half century after Dostoevsky's writing. Most conclusions on agency are that it is the liberty to choose. Yes, it is that. But I think it's so much more. Let's add that it is the key to open-ended spiritual development, and that it is the means by which our individuality or personality may be preserved before the Lord. In other words, the person or individual that we are, perfected to be sure, and cleansed from sin and transgression through the atonement of Jesus Christ, is able to dwell in the presence of the God of the universe and have even friendly working relations with him. So agency is three, at least, things: liberty to choose, a key for the open-ended development of the spirit, and a guarantee of preservation of a righteous personhood. I want to work a bit with the idea of open-ended spiritual development. When we reached a point that could be labeled sentience, we were asked by God if we wanted to grow, be added upon, develop, even to the point of the asker of these questions. We said yes, and were given the key of agency, which opened up for us an unlimited future, or the only limits being the ones we might place on it through our own volition. We rejoiced and celebrated as the bestowal of this great gift. See the opening few paragraphs at the beginning of this chapter, the comments by James and Lewis. Now consider the play Faust by Goethe. In it, Faust, rich, bored, educated to the limits of his society, is approached by Mephistopheles, Lucifer. Faust wants to die. He sees no reason to keep living. Lucifer makes a deal. If he can show Faust something for which Faust would say, life has meaning, it has worth, then would his soul belong to Lucifer? Faust agrees. He's shown an emperor over a vast empire. He's rich and powerful. Faust says no, boring, dead end. He's shown a wealthy merchant with lands and ships doing trade. Ho-hum, says Faust. He's shown a Muslim with a harem and all these beautiful women. Boring, says Faust. Then he's shown a young couple with their own land. They have the freedom to do with their land as they please, to develop it, to develop themselves and grow and learn in any direction they choose, to bring a family into this and engage in their development. Faust says yes, that freedom, that open-ended, limitless expansion of the soul and the intellect with the partner of one's choosing. Yes, that's the ultimate gift, the ultimate non-boring, eternally challenging role for the spirit of man. Yes, he'll take that. Tough, says Lucifer, and grabs his soul. We ought to see the irony in that. The minute Faust appreciates his agency and potential, he loses it all to Satan. Karl Popper, previously cited, says Socrates and Kant, who both were accused by their societies of perverting the state religion and corrupting the minds of the young, stood strong for this concept of freedom. Freedom meant more to them than an absence of constraint. It was for both a way of life. From Socrates' apology and from his death, there sprang a new idea of a free man, the idea of a man whose spirit cannot be subdued, of a man who is free because he is self-sufficient, who is not in need of constraint because he is able to rule himself and to accept freely the rule of law. Kant has shown that every man is free, not because he is born free, but because he is born with the burden of responsibility for free decision. Page 183. Benjamin Constant, a British philosopher of the 19th century, combined those same ideas of freedom and development in these thoughts. Quote, I bear witness to the better part of our nature, that noble disquiet which pursues and torments us, that a desire to broaden our knowledge and develop our faculties. It is not to happiness alone, it is to self-development that our destiny calls us. And political liberty is the most powerful, the most effective means of self-development that heaven has given us. End quote. The Pursuit of Happiness, Darren M. McMahon, page 343. Thank you, Mr. Constant. That is my book in a nutshell. But that's the point of agency. Are you bored? Dead end? Not unless you've sinned greatly and there's no righteous option left for you. And if you are listening to this podcast, believe me, no matter what, that's not the case. We have been given the gift of open-ended spiritual development. If you currently see yourself as stuck, dead-end, bored, re-examine your life. In what directions may you strike out in new development? Include skills, crafts, education, talents. What great books have you not read? There are so many I doubt any of us have read, even 1% of them. And there is much to be said for the hobby that doesn't take over too much of our lives. Painting, sewing, writing. Surely there is something. Life is worth living, but we have to pursue it and experiment with rightful things. The gifts of God to us are life and the key to develop it up to and including parity with Him. But He will hold us accountable for what we have done and are doing with this life. He may offer you a few suggestions and help, but largely, your life is yours to work with. As I said earlier, I have a rock core attitude that agency is paramount sacred in our cosmic life. My personal feelings on this are that I would rather fail as myself than succeed as some programmed automaton. True, I may not inherit the celestial realms, but what I do gain will be what I gained with grace, coupled with my own true self, my own individual personality, and not some factory-cloned ideal of the perfect human. But not all share this attitude, even though they are currently in the realms of agency and choice. There are many who would force their ideas of religion or irreligion on others at sword point. The attitude of coercion isn't limited to those professing religion. Many have been the bloody excesses by those of atheistic persuasion in communist lands during the 20th century against those who believed in God. Coercion and denial of agency, at least to other groups that don't share the same beliefs, is a human problem, not a problem limited to religion. It is one of our major shortcomings as human beings, and is manifested even in parents who can't let children express their agency, which, as a parent, I must admit, has to be handled carefully. There are some things you just can't let your children do, especially when they're young. I've found parenting to be a constant backing away of letting your children do things today that were forbidden yesterday. For example, I won't let my 13-year-old drive the car. In a couple of years, he'll be able to drive it with me sitting beside him, then in another year, alone. I think God operates the same way with us, knowing when to clamp down, when to let up, and let go. These are skills that make for good parents, and God is ultimately the greatest parent. Hitler claimed all history was the struggle of the races for dominance. Marx claimed all history was the struggle of economic classes. They were both wrong. All history is based on the struggle of agency versus coercion. This fight originated in the premortal existence, as we've seen above. It continues here on earth. The Greeks fought the Persians for the freedom to maintain their way of life versus Persian despotism in the Persian Wars, as chronicled by Herodotus. Iranians, descendants of the Persians, today would fight that same battle, trying to take freedom from the West. Numerous have been the conflicts between the forces of freedom and coercion. World War II versus Hitler, a prime example, our Cold War versus Soviet dictatorship, and now our war against Islamofascism, which would impose Sharia law on the world, a law which, as practiced in Afghanistan by the Taliban, wouldn't even allow men to shave beards, people to have songbirds like canaries, and we all know the extreme prohibitions they place on women. Women weren't allowed to go to zoos, for hell's sake. Jordan Peterson, previously cited, writes, quote, "We rebel against our own totalitarianism as much as that of others. I cannot merely order myself to action, and neither can you. I will stop procrastinating, I say, but I don't. I have a nature, and so do you, and so do we all. We must discover that nature and contend with it before making peace with ourselves. What is it that we most truly are? What is it that we could most truly become, knowing who we most truly are? We must get to the very bottom of things before such questions can be truly answered." Page 193, previously cited. But let's not say the problem of freedom versus coercion is a purely religious situation. The problem is not religion or not. The problem is force and coercion. I don't think Satan's highest priority is whether we're religious or not. It's probably on his top 10 list. But I think his first desire is to rob us of our agency. Those who seek to do that, whether religious or atheist, are unwittingly, I hope, following Satan's plan. This is the ultimate battle. All else is diversionary. One of the best visions of these particular events was that of Mosiah Lyman Hancock in an unpublished record of a type of near-death experience or vision in which he was shown these premortal existence debates. Dwayne S. Crowther, Life Everlasting, previously cited, pages 93 through 100. At some milestone in our spiritual education, it was decided that we were ready for the mortal experience. Quote, "All at once there was a gathering of these spirits, and the voice of the great eternal, for that is what we called God there, spoke. O ye my children, we have an earth prepared for you, on which you can dwell and have a chance to come up through obeying our heavenly laws. The great eternal asks for a volunteer to, quote, go down and set an example of humility and faithfulness to these my children, that they may be brought through obedience to our laws back into our presence, end quote. Two volunteer, one who says, Father, I will go down and set a pattern of humility and patience that your children, through my example, may be brought back again with the glory to go to the Father. The second, who had the appearance of a very high military officer, said, I will go down to yonder earth, and surely I will bring all your children back to you, so none of them will be lost. But in accomplishing a 100% redemption rate, he also wanted God's honor and glory, as mentioned above, and wanted an elimination of our agency. Ironically, Lucifer, who tried to destroy choice and agency, became an unwitting facilitator of agency. It is he who provides us with an alternative to the commands, counsel, wisdom, and love of God. Just like we can always use Hitler as the ultimate bad example, so God is able to use Satan for his ends. Professor Nibley writes, quote, the contrast and choice between the way of light and the way of darkness is made possible by Satan's presence upon the earth. The concept of this world as a double sphere of light and darkness, good and evil, war and peace, meets us in the earliest meaningful human documents, the prehistoric palette seals, reliefs on temples, and designs on clay vessels. The purpose of these two conflicting ways is, if God had not given men a double inclination to both good and bad, he, man, would have been incapable either of virtue or of vice. But as it is, he is endowed with a capacity for both. Nibley on the Timely and the Timeless, page 35. I wondered for a while why Satan didn't just quit tempting people. That would be the end of God's plan for growth by choice for us. No choice, no agency. No agency, no growth. No agency, and God's work comes to a screeching halt. I came to the conclusion that Satan has no agency. Because he sought to destroy the agency of man, he lost his, and has no choice but to tempt us and thereby provide us with choice. How ironic. Trying to pull the wool over God's eyes is like playing poker. Not that God plays poker. With someone who knows where every card is in the deck, what cards you have in your hand, what cards you're going to discard and draw, and same for his hand. Further, he can change the cards at will. The Queen of Hearts you thought you had turns into a Three of Clubs. Imagine playing poker with someone like that and thinking, I can beat this guy. God's ultimate triumph over Satan is a done deal. As soon as he has served his purpose of giving us choice and letting us prove ourselves, he'll be bound and we'll have the peace we need to consolidate and enjoy our eternal lives. I will be more surprised if things don't turn out this way than if the sun doesn't rise tomorrow. From there, we must take into account that the existence of evil is indeed part of God's plan for us. Dennis Prager, previously cited, writes, quote, the God of biblical monotheism allows people to commit evil. God permitted the Nazis to murder 6 million Jews because it is a fundamental tenet of Judaism that God gives people moral freedom that they may leave as... Dennis Prager, previously cited, writes, the God of biblical monotheism allows people to commit evil. God permitted the Nazis to murder 6 million Jews because it is a fundamental tenet of Judaism that God gives people moral freedom. That may leave us emotionally unsatisfied, but the only alternative is that God would prevent any bad act from ever taking place. Would we really want to live in a world where people had no moral freedom? Dennis Prager, Think a Second Time, page 242. He goes on to poignantly ask, is being a good automaton preferable to being a free human being? Would we rather be loved by freely choosing people or by love robots? End quote. The ultimate use of our agency is to choose to love God. Howard Storm treats the subject thus in My Descent into Death, pages 78 through 79, previously cited. Quote, you have been given the greatest gift God gives to his people, the ability to accept God's love or refuse it, is the greatest freedom and attribute God gives to any person. God will not force love on anyone. True love has to be freely given and freely received. Love has no strings attached. God will not demand your love. That defeats the very nature of love. Love must be a choice. You cannot scare people into loving. That is not love. It is submission. God doesn't want slaves. God wants people to freely choose love. In what amounts to a vote, Lucifer's plan was rejected 2/3 to 1/3, but that wasn't good enough for him. He went about heaven campaigning for his viewpoint until it got to the level of serious argument from which battle lines were drawn. The war in heaven, as Scripture calls it, was fairly well matched as another 1/3 of God's children chose to be neutral. The result was that Lucifer, as the Scriptures avouch, Revelations 12:4-9, was cast out of heaven with his followers. Hancock reports that even in pre-existent heaven, free choice reigned. Obviously it did with Lucifer and his 1/3, but it continued with us. In classroom situations, as we prepared to come to earth, we'd be asked, "Will you obey the gospel of Jesus Christ when you go to that earth?" Some would answer, "Yes, but not all." Sometimes the question would be asked of a male, "Will you obey that higher law?" And he would answer, "I wish to enjoy myself with the females." Sometimes when the question would be asked of a female, she would reply, "I wish to enjoy myself with the males." Previously cited, page 97. One assumes that higher law is marital fidelity, only upon which eternal marriage relationships can be built. Certainly you see the playing out of these choices now, and the family disruption and unhappiness it brings, an instability and confusion that could never do in eternal realms and circumstances. In areas beside marriage, partnerships also reigned. In classroom situations, quote, "I saw there were those who were proficient in their classes were advanced more rapidly until they became most perfect in those heavenly teachings. But some males, even there in heaven, would neglect their females and their classes and not meet with them. They would go off arm in arm, as men now go, not having any desire for their duties." Page 97. I wonder if these were gays. If so, then one could assume that the gay nature is something we were in our original or intelligence form. This may be a settling of the conundrum as to whether gays are made or come to earth that way, not that I'm going to push it as such. Since God didn't create us per se, but created spirit bodies, then temporal bodies for us, a gay can't say, "God made me this way." He didn't. You have always been that way from your beginnings as a potential. I do think, though, that one can change sexual orientation. We're given this mortal life to work these things out. If one who has these inclinations, decides he wants to go on to a higher development, which the gay lifestyle will prohibit, more on this in a later chapter, then through much trial, effort, and repentance, I think God would, with our complete permission and acquiescence, effect a change in our basic nature. Those organizations and institutions which try to change gay nature now are probably going about it wrong. I realize these things are not from canonized scripture, but I believe these contingencies have been provided for in the scriptural canon. In the book of Joel, Old Testament, chapter 2, verse 28, he prophesies of the last days, quote, "And it shall come to pass afterward that I will pour out my spirit upon all flesh, and your sons and your daughters shall prophesy, your old men shall dream dreams, and your young men shall see visions," end quote. My feeling is that the plethora of near-death experiences and other sources we increasingly have available to us are an indication that perhaps that prophecy is being fulfilled. It behooves us to be open to the voice of God from whatever legitimate source it comes. Revelation is not a closed book. Agency can be summed up in the poem circulating Boston in the early 19th century, "Know this, that every soul is free." I quote it here in its entirety. The author is anonymous. Know this, that every soul is free to choose his life and what he'll be. For this eternal truth is given, that God will force no man to heaven. He'll call, persuade, direct aright, and bless with wisdom, love, and light. In nameless ways be good and kind, but never force the human mind. Freedom and reason make us men. Take these away, what are we then? Mere animals, and just as well, the beast may think of heaven or hell. May we no more our powers abuse, but ways of truth and goodness choose. Our God is pleased when we improve his grace and seek his perfect love. My feelings are that agency covers not just choice and open-ended spiritual development, but our entire personalities. What is your personality? Sober, serious, weird streak of humor, outgoing, introverted, intelligent, introspective, gregarious, loner. There are many descriptions and degrees of each quality. The point is, you are who you are, and God not only will not interfere with your agency, he won't change who and what you are. God respects, indeed demands, that you be you, albeit the best you you can be. Ralph Waldo Emerson wrote penetratingly and wisely on the importance of being an individual. These quotes are from his essay on self-reliance in a book titled The Writings of Ralph Waldo Emerson. Quote, "To believe your own thought, to believe that what is true for you in your private heart is true for all men, that is genius. In every work of genius, we recognize our own reflected thoughts. They come back to us with a certain alienated majesty." End quote. Page 145. Quote, "There is a time in every man's education when he arrives at the conviction that envy is ignorance, that imitation is suicide. Though the wide universe is full of good, no kernel of nourishing corn can come to him but through his toil bestowed on that plot of ground which is given to him to till." Consider this in the light of today's Me Too bandwagon approach to TV programming. Well, movies too. Well, virtually any successful corporate endeavor. Quote, "Trust thyself. Accept the place the divine providence has found for you, the society of your contemporaries, the connection of events. The virtue in most request is conformity. Self-reliance is its aversion. It loves not realities and creators, but names and customs. Whoso would be a man must be a nonconformist. Insist on yourself, never imitate. Your own gift you can present every moment with the cumulative force of a whole life's cultivation. But of the adopted talent of another, you have only an extemporaneous half-possession. That which each can do best, none but his maker can teach him." Page 148. Quote, "The other terror that scares us from self-trust is our consistency, a reverence for our past act or word, because the eyes of others have no other data for computing our orbit than our past acts, and we are loath to disappoint them. Why drag about this corpse of memory, lest you contradict somewhat you have stated in this or that public place? Politicians and political commentators take note. Suppose you should contradict yourself, what then? A foolish consistency is the hobgoblin of little minds, adored by little statesmen and philosophers and divines. The voyage of the best ship is a zigzag line of 100 tacks. See the line from a sufficient distance, and it straightens itself to the average tendency." End quote. In Emerson's time, ships sailed with the wind, and if the wind was against them, they had to sail back and forth at angles to the wind, tacking, to get where they were going. Previously cited, page 152. Although the writings of Emerson strike all kinds of responsive chords in my soul, I still have to temporize. We are standing on the shoulders of giants. There's no sense jumping off their shoulders and complaining we can't see the view. There's no need to reinvent the wheel. When do we think in the box? When out? There's a time and a place for both. When is the time for which? He who can deal with those problems is the man or the woman that will solve the world's problems. But that's not a discussion for here. God, like Emerson, doesn't want you being some poor carbon copy of someone else, though Jesus Christ is a role model for us in how we should behave and conduct our lives. But we can be Christ-like and still maintain our personalities. Consider his 12 apostles in the New Testament. There was Peter, who was impulsive, doubting Thomas, Nathanael, in whom there was no guile, John, the apostle of love. Some were fishermen, one was a tax collector, one a tent maker. Each were definitely different individuals. Each followed Christ closely enough to be considered as one with him and his immediate successors. They didn't lose their personality or humanity, only weak and evil tendencies. As to how we can combine individuality and being a part of the whole, consider a jigsaw puzzle, as mentioned in the first chapter. Each piece is an individual. It has a border of protrusions and indentations unique to itself, so no other piece is like it. Plus, it has a unique design on it as part of the whole picture. But it must be fitted in with all the other pieces to complete the puzzle. Does fitting it in cause it to lose its individuality? No, its uniqueness remains, but fitted in, it contributes to the whole. If a 1,000-piece puzzle is assembled and one piece is missing, the eye immediately is drawn to that vacant spot, and the puzzle assembler goes looking for that missing piece. Is it left in the box? Did the cat snatch it and take it off somewhere to chew on? Like the puzzle pieces, each of us is unique and individual. Yet each of us has a place and a role to play in the whole. We don't lose our personality or individuality by being put into the whole picture. Howard Storm's near-death experience gave him an insight into God's respect for our individuality. When we leave mortality, escorting angels appear, quote, "They will take you from the reality of this physical universe and transport you to a new reality, where you get your first introduction to the wonder and power of God. There are as many entry points into heaven as there are individuals. Each person is escorted toward heaven according to his or her life, culture, and spiritual level. One person may be in a beautiful field, another may be in a magnificent castle, another in a setting similar to their grandparents' home. God and his angels, for the specific comfort and beginning edification of that person, individually create each setting. It is difficult for us to understand and believe how much God cares about and respects our individuality." Howard Storm, previously quoted, pages 51 through 2. Brigham Young, the Mormon prophet, spoke of the sacredness of our individuality in relation to God thus, quote, "The greatest gift that God can bestow upon the children of men is the gift of eternal life. That is to give mankind power to preserve their identity, to preserve themselves before the Lord." End quote. Journal of Discourses, Volume 6, page 333. As to bad or evil traits and personality manifestations, he will help you change them for good if you truly desire and come to him for help. But the original person will still be there. Nothing wrong with basic ambition, for example, but if that ambition leads one to dishonesty and to stepping on others to get ahead in life as one desires and only as one desires, God would help one channel that ambition for good and control it when temptations to use it for evil arise. Betty Eady illustrates it thus, quote, "We are given agency to act for ourselves here. Our own actions determine the course of our lives, and we can alter or redirect our lives at any time. God made the promise that he wouldn't intervene in our lives unless we asked him, and then through his omniscient knowledge, he would help us attain our righteous desires." Embraced by the Light, page 49, previously cited. As I go back over these quotes on God's gift of agency to us, I see the verb won't in virtually every application, as in God won't interfere with our agency, I never see the verb can't. A small word, a big difference. Many use the argument that if God can't do something, then he isn't all-powerful, therefore he is a myth. With agency, it's not that he can't, it's that he won't. By his own volition, he made a covenant with us that he would hold our agency, a gift from him in any event, sacred and inviolate. The debate isn't whether he has the power. He does, for he is omnipotent. The realization must be made on our part that he uses his powers wisely, with restraint, for our own growth and development towards our ultimate good. I heard an argument for atheism recently based on the simple logic that if God was infinitely powerful, omnipotent, then there would be no room for evil. But since there is evil, God can't be infinitely powerful, and therefore there is no God. Well, that is a simple, clever little logical trick, but the thinking is shallower than my mud puddle. Consider the United States, Russia, or China, the Cold War era. Did we not have enough nuclear weapons to destroy the planet several times over? And did we? Thank God, no. But the absence of a burnt-out, irradiated Earth is not proof of our lack of power, any more than the presence of evil is proof of an absence of God. God has all power, but the reason that he is God is that he knows when to use his power and when to hold back. For the purposes of our growth and development, he restrains his power to destroy evil. He has bigger fish to fry. Let us compare God to a gardener. A good gardener knows his seeds, when and where to plant them, and what special fixtures they need. Spinach can be sown in early spring in cold, boggy soil, well amended with manure. If one sows his peas there, the crop will be all leaves and stems and no peas. If one sows tomatoes, they'll die. As the spinach grows, it needs no staking or strings to climb upon, as do tomatoes and beans. We come to God as a seed with basic yet infinite variations on our needs. Each seed is an individual plant with its own special and peculiar set of requirements for optimum growth and future fruit production. As I wrote above about God not taking the ambition from an ambitious soul, but helping that soul channel that force for good, one could compare that to pruning of a fast-growing plant. If a plant as such as grapes is left unpruned, it will waste too much energy in making leaves, stems, and vines, and will have little left over for grapes, its ultimate purpose. Grapes have to be pruned annually and severely. I have known individuals with boisterous, outrageous, outgoing personalities which had constantly got them into trouble. Their native impulsiveness had to be pruned back often. But as they matured, they became fine and responsible people. Howard Storm phrases it much the same. You plant the seed, you water it, you prune the plant, you tend it, but it has a life of its own. Anyone who gardens knows that the more in tune you are in allowing the thing to be what it can become, rather than forcing it, the more effective you are in helping it develop to its full potential. Previously cited, page 70. One of the great secrets of the cosmos is that the whole cosmos is an apparent contradictory mix of same and different. There is no contradictions. As humans, we are all the same, and we are all different. The same part of the cosmos is equality. God is fair and treats his children fairly. The different part of the cosmos, as alluded to above, in consideration of our individuality, must be carefully mixed with the same part so both can be preserved. An understanding of the principle of equality needs to be discussed here. Many misunderstand it. Will we all be equal in the cosmos? Yes. Will we all be different? Yes. How can that be? The principle of equality is best applied in the overall general. For example, all in the cosmos will have access to any learning facility they need to develop their talents. If one chooses to learn how to express the beauties of nature via art, and another chooses to learn how to form a planet from the physical forces of the universe, are they unequal? No. Both have their personality needs met, even if they are different. Another vision of equality pictures the United States, for example, as a great melting pot where all peoples and cultures come together in a great mix and wind up as one big homogeneous melting together. Phooey. I see America rather as a stew. In a good stew, I love a good stew. You can easily recognize the individual pieces, the meat, the potatoes, carrots, onions, maybe celery, all swimming in a rich, thick gravy. Each piece has contributed some of its flavor to the whole, and each piece has picked up some of the flavor of the surrounding mix. But each piece has retained the greater portion of its individuality. Are they equal? Well, they're all stew, yet they're still individuals. You can tell the carrots from the meat, the potatoes from the onions, and, if you're like my wife, pick out the meat. But that's another issue. I think this is how equality is approached in the cosmos. If we're going to celebrate diversity, then let's be sure we have a diversity to celebrate. And now let me pass on a favorite family recipe for stew. What is a recipe for stew doing in a book on God, the cosmos, and our human part in it? But if I didn't pass this on to you, I'd feel I'd shortchanged you. So here we go. Assemble your usual ingredients, beef chunks, potatoes, carrots, seasonings, whatever. And here's the secret. Throw in a can of condensed cream of mushroom soup and a can of condensed tomato soup. Don't add water. Just the condensed soup from the can. Stir all ingredients well and simmer in a crock pot until the meat and potatoes are tender. The two soups mix and form a rich golden brown gravy. In fact, we call it golden gravy stew, and it's been a family favorite for decades. There you have it, a recipe for stew in a book about humanity in the cosmos. Who'd have thunk it? But let us first put this into context. Inequality exists in the cosmos, not because God has forced it on us, but because of the choices we make and the resultant consequences. Many near-death experiencers tell of greater glories and happier kingdoms to which the traveler cannot presently go. It's a matter of an increasing maturity and readiness, then the way will be opened. God is the God of all life, including those lives that choose evil. They're given their choice, but as they'd be a corrupting and polluting influence on the younger spirits coming along, they must be thrown out and then confined, as mentioned in the prologue. Consider it in this light. Supposing you're one of the parents in a family of 10 children. Most of your kids are pretty good, but there are a couple that have decided to drop out of school, get into drugs, child pornography, petty theft, and are abusive and, worse, influential on their younger siblings. With great sorrow in your heart, you have to remove these grossly disobedient elements from the family circle. You can't have them spoiling the whole lot. It is a hard, tough love parental choice and action. But for the sake of the good part of the family, what's left of it, it must be done. Multiply that by virtually infinity, and you have the situation God was in, as described in Revelations 12, 7 through 9, where a third of the host of heaven were cast out. And no, God won't just wave his magic wand and change all the evil spirits to good. As stated in abundance above, he won't fool their agency, personality, and choice. But he has to take action after warning us when we use our agency wrongly. To sum up then on agency, Howard Storm details it thus in his book previously cited, page 38. God doesn't control or dictate the outcome of every event, which would be a violation of God's creation. This is because every bit of energy and matter has its own integrity and course to fulfill. Every living creature has its own will that must be expressed. Each conscious being has its own learning to be experienced. Every action serves God's purpose by fulfilling its nature, including the total range of activity from negative to positive. The outcome will always serve God's ultimate purpose, no matter how long or how impossible it appears to us. But the bottom line, the choice is stark, literally night and day, happiness or misery, and oddly, there are many who choose dark and miserable. Fully one-third of the children of God in heaven have already made this strange-to-us choice. The book of Revelations in the Bible details the conflict. Quote, "And his tail drew the third part of the stars of heaven, and did cast them to the earth. And there was war in heaven. Michael and his angels fought against the dragon. And the dragon fought and his angels, and prevailed not. Neither was their place found any more in heaven. And the great dragon was cast out, that old serpent called the devil, and Satan, which deceiveth the whole world. He was cast out into the earth, and his angels were cast out with him." Revelations chapter 12, verses 4 through 9. And there was what in heaven? War and fighting? And a third of God's children were thrown out? This is heaven. So much for warm and fuzzy. So much for sitting on a cloud and playing a harp. So much for eternally singing praises in some celestial choir. Yes, it seems there's a lot more blood and guts reality to the upper realms than religious mythology has given us. Near-death experiences offer us great glimpses into these immortal realms, and that is where we're going now to get a realistic picture of the eternal cosmos from which we sprang and to which we're going to find a place for this the rest of our lives. But before we move on to the next chapter in the next podcast, let's bring the two themes of this chapter together, the plan and agency, and bring in a third guest, the atheist point of view from Harper's Magazine, July 2012, pages 73 through 78. In their book review section, they had a compiled review of three books, all written by atheists and people who could be called among the leading thinkers of that particular philosophy. I'll just concentrate on one, Alex Rosenberg, who chaired the philosophy department at Duke University. This is no wacko dressed in rags and howling in the street. In an excerpt from his book, The Atheist Guide to Reality, Harper's has him saying, "What science and scientism tell those who hanker for more is get over it," page 74. Harper's notes one is mostly left noticing how much scientism takes from us and how little it offers in return, page 75. Finally, Rosenberg plainly states, quote, "It's futile to seek a good reason to go on living because there isn't any," end quote. Continuing, quote, "In exchange for giving up our reasons for living, Rosenberg offers us medication. If meaninglessness makes it impossible to get out of bed in the morning, you should try Prozac." Harper's reports this isn't a passing suggestion. It appears repeatedly throughout his book. So what should we scientific folks do when overcome by world weariness? Take two of whatever neuropharmacology prescribes. If you don't feel better in the morning, or 3 weeks from now, switch to another one. There follows a list of antidepressant prescription drugs. And if one doesn't work, another one probably will." End quote. A lot of religious people believe atheists are in for a nasty surprise, that they will find themselves in a flaming hell that never ends. I hope we've put that out to pasture where it belongs. In A World Beyond, Ruth Montgomery, previously cited, does give us a look at atheists as they pass from death to the next life. Quote, "At first he is astonished, then resentful, because he feels that this is a hallucination. Little by little, he grudgingly accepts that he was wrong, and he becomes eager, even avid, to learn all about this sphere, which for him had previously been non-existent." Page 39. No flaming hell. Just a slow awakening to the eternal realities now staring him in the face. So, dear readers, here is your choice, meaninglessness mitigated by prescription drugs, or a plan from a God who is our Father and will, at its ultimate fulfillment, raise us to his level for an exciting and eternal future in the work of creating and populating universes and being intimately involved with the progress of the human race. As this chapter was about agency as well as the plan, there's your choice. Best wishes. Now, let's meet God and see what he and his heaven are like. And thus we conclude this 9th podcast of the series, Becoming Human in the Cosmos, based on the book I have on Amazon. The next podcast will be titled Chapter 5, God and Heaven, Part 1, and we'll deal with God and Heaven. Join me, please, and thanks for tuning in, and special thanks to Craig and Kate Whitmore, my technical personnel, without whom this podcast and my website wouldn't even exist in the cloud as dust particles. Visit our website at hazelleproductions.com, HAZELLEPRODUCTIONS.com. Thank you for tuning in.